Welcome everyone to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum. My name is Joseph Henry, and I'm going to be the moderator for today's Tax Tuesday series Practitioners Forum. As a reminder, our forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call will be on February 5th, so please mark your calendars. And some of you are saying, wait a minute, today's not the first Tuesday of the month. You're absolutely right. We're doing it the second Tuesday in January because of the New Year's holiday. So happy New Year to everyone. Thanks again for joining us. And we look forward to the rest of the year and having a lot of these practitioners forums to help you guys answer your questions. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all participants that we have on today. We asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you did respond. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. So that means that I will submit or on the lookout the questions box or the chat box, and I will open it up to those who are attending to either come on the line live and ask your question, or you can also feel free to type it in the questions box, which I see a few of you have already done. So thank you very much for doing that. So again, I will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask you to type your question in the question box or just tell me that you want to be unmuted, and I will unmute you so that you can ask your question live. All right, thank you very much for that. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin with today's call. Joining us, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. So, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, and be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, it's this practitioner's call. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to visit our website at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. Again, if you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted and referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And on that note, yes, if you go to taxresolutioninstitute.org on our homepage, you'll see the upcoming events. And I do want to highlight the two events that are coming up here in January. The first one that's coming up next Tuesday is Tax Resolution A to Z. This is a course that covers the high-level topics of every aspect of tax resolution, from audits to $0 installment agreements. Get it, A to Z. So, yeah, please check us out there. Right now, the course is for $59, but hang on to for an announcement later down the road during this forum. I want to give you guys a little Happy New Year gift here from us at the Tax Resolution Institute. The next one, which is also very popular during this time because of all the changes, is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Some of you may know it as TCJA, so now you know the lingo. But yeah, join us. That's going to be in 2 weeks from now, January 22nd. We do have another webinar that does cover the changes with Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So if you're interested in learning more, I know there's been a lot of information released out there, but you need some clarification. Peter Stefan actually has a one-hour event giving you all the updates. So join us for those two webinars. And again, hang on. Later down this forum, I will make sure that I give you a special offer to have you guys attend those two events. All right, Norman, what do you say we get started with some of these questions? As a reminder, VIP members to our website have preference during these forum calls. And what that basically means is that you get your questions answered when you submit them online or via chat here during the live event. So our first series of questions here are coming directly from our VIP members. So again, we thank you, and let's move on to the questions. First one's coming from Rajendra. Rajendra is an EA, and his question is, taxpayer recently filed the last 4 years' returns with federal tax, approximately $50 to $60K per year due, but no payments included. The IRS sent notice CP-14 for 2016 and 17 only. No IRS notice received for 14 and 15 yet. Taxpayer cannot full pay and will request some payment plan from the IRS. He has no real estate or any other significant assets, but makes around $300,000 a year in sales commissions. Should he be quiet and wait to hear from the IRS about 14 and 15 before responding to the current CP-14? How should he respond? Thanks.
And so the problem with this case is if he ignores 14 and 15 because he hasn't received any notices yet and responds to 16 and 17 and sets up an installment agreement, that installment agreement is only going to be for 16 and 17. And when 14 and 15 posts, he's going to default the installment agreement for 16 and 17. So you really want to wait until 14 and 15 also posts so you can set up the installment agreement for all 4 years. And is he going to owe for 2018 this time of year? That's always a big question of if they're going to owe for the upcoming tax return, because if they are and they don't pay it when they file their return, then they're going to default whatever installment agreement you set up. So any installment agreements that you set up, you know, January, February, March, beginning of April, if they're going to owe for the upcoming return, you want to include that in the installment agreement by either waiting, or you can set up what they call a pre-assessment installment agreement, which means that it's set up for the years that they owe already, and the upcoming year is going to be included pre-assessment, but that doesn't always work. A lot of times it falls through the cracks and they end up getting a default notice. So I guess all you can do is call and respond to the notices on 16 and 17 and say that 14 and 15 hasn't posted yet, and you want more time because you want to set up an installment agreement for all 4 years, but you want to wait till all the years post to make sure that you don't default.
Thank you very much, Norman, for that. And absolutely, you want to make sure that all 4 years have posted before you set up an installment agreement for just two. Another quick way of doing that, as recommended here by someone online, David, is suggesting you run transcripts to see what's going on with the other years that you haven't received a notice for. So thank you very much, David, for your input there. Moving on to Ed. Ed is an attorney, also a VIP member, and his question is, I want to request that penalties be abated for a longtime client of mine that did not respond to my emails regarding filing extensions or submitting organizers for last year's tax prep work. We did not file an extension and now has a failure to file, failure to pay penalties totaling about $3,600. Will this qualify for the first-time penalty abatement program? He's been a responsible taxpayer and this time just got ill.
So there's two ways of going about this. And I'll tell you what I think is the best sequence. You can get penalties abated either under the first time penalty abatement program, where it looks like this taxpayer may qualify, but you can also get penalties abated by reasonable cause. And the fact that he was ill may, if he has doctor notes or something, may establish reasonable cause. And you always want to attempt reasonable cause first before first time penalty abatement, because you want to kind of save the first time penalty abatement for when you really need it, because you can only use it once. That's why it's called first time. And who knows what's going to happen in the future. And there, he may not have an excuse. So what I would do is first apply for penalty abatement under reasonable cause because of his illness. And if that's rejected, then I would request first time penalty abatement. And if he qualifies, then you get it that way. But I would try reasonable cause first and kind of save first time penalty as like a wild card that you can use later if you have to.
All right, Ed, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Mary. Mary is a CPA, also a VIP member, is asking, if a taxpayer has been assessed tax for 2015 but is now unemployed and considering filing for personal bankruptcy, will the taxpayer's tax debts be released into personal bankruptcy? I apologize, 2014, not 15.
Yeah, so we have to assume a lot. So first of all, Mary, as a CPA, I think your obligation is just to tell the taxpayer that he may qualify to having the taxes discharged in bankruptcy and that he should consult with a bankruptcy attorney and preferably a bankruptcy attorney with experience discharging taxes. I don't think it's because he's going to have to file bankruptcy with an attorney. And I think it's the attorney's obligation to determine whether or not the tax is dischargeable or not. I don't think it's your obligation or you should be making that call. But what you can tell the taxpayer is, if 2014 was timely filed, that is, if it was due in April and he filed in April, or it was on extension till October and he filed in October, and there aren't any other tolling events like appeals, CAP or CDP or tax court or whatever, it should be dischargeable and that he should consult a bankruptcy attorney, because 2014, the due date of the return was April or October of 2015. And since we're already past October of 2018, it's been more than 3 years. So he's met the 3-year rule. And if he timely filed the return, that it's been more than 2 years since he's filed it, and it should have been assessed, you know, a while ago, so more than 240 days ago. So it should be dischargeable. But again, that's not your call. But you definitely could give the taxpayer a heads up that he may be a candidate and he should consult a bankruptcy attorney.
Yeah, there's also tolling events that could have occurred. So something to take into consideration. Thank you very much, Mary. Moving on to Claire. Claire is a CPA, and she's asking, would the IRS make you sell your home that has a lot of equity before putting you in non-collectible status?
No, but what they would make you do is apply for a home equity loan. So that's the thing, is that if you have equity in your home and you can tap into it, then the IRS wants that equity and you can pay back your home equity loan on your own. They're not really concerned about that. So what you need to do is advise the taxpayer to apply for a home equity loan. And actually, in this case, if they're denied the home equity loan, it's not necessarily a bad thing because you can show the IRS that they applied for a home equity line of credit and it was denied. And so they can't tap into it. So it's not available to them. And I don't know how much they owe and how much equity they have in their home. And there's a lot of ifs, but generally the IRS is not looking to sell people's homes from out from under them, but they are looking for taxpayers to tap into their home equity if they can. And so they're going to insist that they apply. They're going to want to see a copy of the application to see that the taxpayer completed it correctly and truthfully. And if the taxpayer comes back with a letter rejecting their home equity loan, then that should be enough to satisfy the IRS that the home equity is not available and may be able to put them in currently non-collectible.
Can you just briefly, Norman, give a little indication of what the IRS looks for when placing people in currently non-collectible? I'm getting a few questions about that.
Yeah, so first of all, currently non-collectible, by its definition of current, means it's a temporary status. And it means that the taxpayer at this time does not have sufficient disposable income to pay the IRS more than $25 a month, because $25 a month is the minimum that the IRS will accept on a monthly basis. So if the taxpayer has no disposable income, and you don't want to be negative, because that opens up a whole nother can of worms, is how is the taxpayer making ends meet if their expenses exceed their income every month? And so let's say there's no disposable income, then you would qualify for currently non-collectible, and they wouldn't attempt to collect for up to 2 years, and then they would revisit it and ask for updated financials to see if your financial situation has changed, or if you file your next year's tax return and all of a sudden you've got a good job and you're making good money, then that would kick you out of currently non-collectible earlier, because the IRS has determined that your current income has increased to the point where you can now make installment payments.
Right, and the IRS just doesn't take your word for it. You need to provide financial statements with the
433F. Yeah, if you're calling ACS, and A if you're with a revenue officer.
All right, Claire, there you go. Hopefully that answers your question regarding the selling of the home and CNC status. Moving on to Matt. Matt is an EEA, and he says, I keep hearing conflicting information on discharging taxes in bankruptcy. Can taxes be discharged if the client did not file their own returns and the IRS filed SFRs?
So generally, no. There's been a lot of litigation, and there's cases showing that if the IRS prepared the return and the taxpayer didn't, then that's not considered a return, and you have to have filed a return in order to discharge taxes. So generally speaking, no. There are some circuits that do what's called the Beard test, which is a three-prong test to determine whether or not the taxpayer either didn't file the return in bad faith, in other words, was trying to avoid paying taxes, or if there's a reasonable explanation of why they didn't file a return and why the IRS had to file a return on their behalf. So the circuits that follow the Beer test, there is a chance that the tax could be discharged if you can explain why it wasn't bad faith not to file the return. But most circuits are going with SFRs are automatically non-dischargeable. And again, anything to do with bankruptcy and taxes should go to a bankruptcy attorney and a bankruptcy attorney that has experience discharging taxes, and they should make the call. So I think as an EA, you know, your call is just to tell your taxpayer that probably it will not be dischargeable, and that he before filing bankruptcy, he should get a consultation, but you probably think that it won't be discharged.
All right, there you go, Matt. Moving on to Craig. Craig is also an EA and a VIP member. Can the IRS keep an installment agreement application pending for 3 years, tolling the CSET all that time?
So the answer is, yeah, I've seen it happen. And one thing is, because a pending installment agreement stops collection, so that's why it tolls the collection statute. But it doesn't stop interest. So these 3 years, the clock's ticking, the statute on collection is tolled, but interest continues to accrue. So we really advise our clients that while an installment agreement is pending, they should make voluntary payments in the amount of their proposed installment agreement. Number one, because it lowers their tax liability. And number two, it establishes a pattern and supports the taxpayer's proposal that this is a monthly amount that they can afford to pay towards their taxes. So hopefully they've been making payments these 3 years and their taxes liability is going down rather than not making any payments and the payment and their liability is increasing and it's not, and the clock's not ticking. I would check with whoever that installment agreement proposal was submitted to, whether ACS or revenue officer, and find out why it's taken so long, maybe withdraw the installment agreement request to get the clock ticking. But I would do something. I wouldn't just sit there and let the liability increase like that, because once they do have an installment agreement, the clock starts ticking again, and the IRS has all that time to collect the tax plus now 3 years worth of interest.
That's right. Hopefully we can get something done there. But, yeah, that's a lot of time to just be sitting there idle. Okay, moving on to Christopher. Christopher is a CPA and also a VIP member. Christopher is asking, my client has just been hit with a bank levy last week for about $8,000. They owe the IRS about $25,000. What can be done to have the money returned? Client won't be able to pay his mortgage.
Okay, so first of all, whatever you do, you need to do quickly, because the bank levy instructs the bank to hold on to the funds for somewhere between 14 and 21 days. The state of California is a different number than the IRS, but it's somewhere between 14 and 21 days. And for that time, that's business days. For that time, the bank is instructed to hold on to the money and not send it to the IRS. So the taxpayer can contact the IRS. You probably have a 433F completed, or if it's assigned to a revenue officer, a 433A, which is financials to show what the taxpayer can afford. And they may be able to get some or all of that $8,000 back. I don't know what their mortgage payment is, but I hope it's not $8,000 a month, because that's way above standards, and the IRS isn't going to give them, even if $8,000 was their monthly mortgage payment, the IRS isn't going to give them the $8,000 back, because it exceeds the standards. The other thing is, the IRS doesn't want the taxpayer to have their phone turned off or their electricity turned off, or have them foreclosure, or if they're renting an unlawful detainer. So if the taxpayer has any kind of letter or notice from, let's say they were saving up to pay their mortgage and they were behind, and they received some kind of, you know, notice of default, and they were trying to cure it, I think the IRS in that case would release the money, because the IRS doesn't want to be responsible for a foreclosure. But you would need to have the notice handy and the financials, and you could get some or all of it back, and maybe set up an installment agreement, and they would only hold back maybe the first month or two payment and release the rest. But whatever you do, you need to do quickly, because the time that you have is limited, except the IRS, you can't get through to them now because of the government shutdown. So that's really sticky if the bank levy was sent out by a computer, but there's nobody there that you can respond to. So you might want to check into that, but you need to do something right away.
Yeah, I've received a few phone calls this week where employers received garnishment notices in the beginning of December, and the employee has just been made aware of them. So the employer is required to start garnishing those wages and remit them to the IRS. But if anyone, including us, wanted to put a hold on that, on stop on that, we couldn't, because the IRS is not taking phone calls at the moment. So unfortunately, the taxpayer is in a pretty bad spot, because garnishments will be enforced.
And their fax machine is turned off.
Right.
So I've tried faxing stuff and it didn't work either.
Yeah. So hopefully everything gets fixed here shortly, and we can get back in business soon. But all right, moving on to next question. This is from Jocelyn. Jocelyn is an EA. Her question is, taxpayer owes $90,000 for a few years, but will not qualify for OIC because there is $125,000 equity in his home. What options do we have for a reduced settlement? Can we offer a lower amount since he will be paying it off in full? Guidance is appreciated.
Sorry to be the harbinger of bad news, but an offer is really the only thing that reduces the amount that you owe the IRS. So if they don't qualify for an offer, then all you can do is set up a payment plan for them. And the only way that they're going to pay less than what they owe is if the payment, monthly payment, won't pay off the balance within the statute time. And when the collection statute expires, whatever's left is forgiven. And so other than that, there's really no way to settle it. So I don't know how much time is left on the statute, but what you can hope to do is maybe get a small payment plan, and hopefully it will be a partial pay installment agreement, and the balance will be forgiven when the statute expires. Also, this is another case where there's equity in the home. So again, you're going to need, whatever you do, you're going to need to deal with that. And so the homeowner should apply for a home equity line of credit now and be ready to either have that money available to the IRS or have a rejection of the loan application that they can show the IRS.
Yeah, that equity is going to continue to be an issue in the IRS, regardless of either partial pay installment agreement or a full-page settlement agreement are going to want them to tap into that right away. All right, Jocelyn, hopefully that answers your question. Next up is Monica, also an EA. When a lien is placed on a home, do subsequent interest and penalties get added to that lien?
So the answer is yes. So a lien is like a notice, and it's a notice to, first of all, it secures the IRS's debt, the homeowner's debt to the IRS, and it also gives notice to would-be buyers or lenders that the IRS has a superior lien, and so that the IRS gets paid off. Let's say if the taxpayer sold his home, the IRS would get paid off before the taxpayer would receive any of that equity. And so it's really just for notice purposes. And so the amount on the lien is the amount that was assessed at the time that the lien was recorded. And at this time, it may be more or less. It could be less if the taxpayer, for instance, was an installment agreement or paid down the liability, or it could increase if they didn't make any payments and interest continues to accrue. And so what that tax lien tells escrow company who would be involved in any refinance or sale is to send a demand letter to the IRS asking the IRS to put a demand in escrow on how much they're owed. And again, it may be more or less than the figure on the actual lien notice. But again, that's all it is. It's a notice that the IRS has a lien. It's not a payoff demand. That's done later, and the IRS will send a demand to escrow on the current balance, and that's what needs to be paid off.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to the next question. This is from Caribbean. Caribbean is asking, I have a client that owes the IRS $12,000. She makes $70,000 a year. She does not own a business and does not qualify for the UIC. She is on an installment agreement and is considering taking money from her 401k to settle her debt. How would you advise this client?
I would advise the client to just continue making the installment payments. I don't know why they would want to dip into their 401k to pay it. I think you'd have, I don't know how old the taxpayer is. I don't think it says here, but there may be penalties involved and taxes involved in taking money out of the 401k. So 70,000, I don't want to sound flippant, but it's not a lot of money compared to what some of these other taxpayers owe. And I don't know how much.
No, that's her earnings, 70,000. The liability is
12,000. So the thing is, on a streamlined installment agreement, you would have 72 months to pay off the 12,000. So it's probably going to be not very much. So, and based on, I don't know how big the household is, but based on the standard expenses, 70,000 would require a larger monthly payment than she would get if she did the streamline. So I would do a streamline installment agreement for the 12,000 to be paid over 72 months and leave the 401k alone.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. And Caribbean and everyone else that's on the line, this is a great opportunity just to remind you folks of what our VIP membership does offer. It does offer priority during these practitioners forum calls, but it also gives you access to all of our courses on our website at no cost. You also get access to our knowledge-based library. You get case studies. You get a lot of additional support to help you with any particular case that you might be dealing with. So a lot of these questions can be answered by perusing our knowledge-based library. But also, something that's very important, a lot of people take advantage of this, is using consultation time. Depending on the member level, you do get consultation time with one of our professionals, and that includes Norman, that includes Peter, includes CPAs and EAs here in our office to help guide you with those sticky situations that you may just not know how to handle yourself. And it also includes, on top of resolution work, we do tax consulting as well, or guidance on any tax issues, and also marketing and sales. So we're really a one-stop shop to help you grow your practice. There have been questions that get submitted almost regularly about someone dipping their toes into this type of industry or this type of business and needing some help. The VIP membership will give you some guidance there, because you get the opportunity to speak to one of us who have been doing this for a very long time to help guide you. So take advantage of that. I'm going to push a link to the VIP membership and give you a special promo there. Go ahead, Norm.
I just want to say on this last taxpayer. So if I take the $12,000 and divide it by 72 months, it comes out to be $166.66 a month. So just round up to 170. So, you know, you can get a streamlined installment agreement for 170 a month. I would suggest that and not dip into the 401k.
All right. Thank you, Norman. But I did want to continue and also mention the two courses that are coming up, January 15th and January 22nd, the Tax Resolution A to Z and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, What You Need to Know. Those are the two upcoming courses. And as a thank you for attending today's forum, I am offering a 100% discount, which means you get to attend for free if you use a promo code. I'm pushing the promo code now. You already have the links in the chat box. The promo code is January, just January. Make sure you enter that at checkout, and that'll update the cart so that you don't pay anything for these two upcoming courses. Take advantage of those and sign up for those two courses. You will get a follow-up email with the details. So in case you miss it in the chat box or you didn't jot anything down, I'll email you after the event some details. Also, I do want to mention, this is more of a save the date coming up in the summer of 2019. Actually, the exact dates are June 13th and 14th. Here at the Tax Resolution Institute, we're going to be offering an exclusive two-day seminar on tax resolution. And what I mean by that is we are limiting the seating, I think, to a maximum of 10 people. And we're basically treat this as a workshop. You're going to go ahead and ask any question you had related to tax resolution. Learn from Peter himself, who wrote the book on tax resolution. We're going to include a one-night hotel stay near the venue so that you have accommodations. Food will be provided for breakfast and lunch. It's going to be a very exclusive two-day event that's going to give you the opportunity to really learn resolution from Peter Steffen, who wrote the textbook on tax resolution. If it's something that you're interested in, please send me a message in the chat box, or you can give a call to the office at 818-704-1443. Ask to speak with Joe or David, and again, we'll send a quick save the date on this event as well. All right, enough of that. Let's go ahead and get to the rest of these questions, Norman. The next question is coming from Donald. Donald is a CPA, and he's asking, I have a client who owes the state of California $10,000 in tax and $7,000 in interest. The IRS has accepted her settlement offer 2 years ago with the payment of 10% of the balance. California has told her that because of her age, which is 35, and the fact that she has in the past earned well over $100,000 per year, they will not accept any offer. They further advise her that the statute of for California payments is 20 years. They are content to assess $175 per month in interest. She is a single mother earning less than $12,000 per year. Prospects for returning to a high-paying sales job requiring 80% travel are nil. So he's asking for some guidance
there. Okay, I mean, what you need to do is set up a payment plan, so an installment agreement. So the taxpayer needs to complete a 3562, which is the California installment agreement request financial statements and determine the taxpayer's ability to pay. Usually they want to be paid within 3 years, but if you take the 17,000 and divide by 36, it comes out to be about $475 a month, which for somebody making 12,000 a year is probably out of the question. So what she needs to do is request hardship status and set up a payment plan that she can afford. So, and hopefully, it's going to be accepted by the FTB. But again, even their hardships, they look at it again every year, where the IRS might do it every 2 years. So be prepared for every year that the taxpayer is going to have to submit current financials to establish that this is the best they can do. I have such a installment agreement set up for a client who owes like $1 million and is paying like $50 a month or something. I mean, but that's all she can afford. But every year we have to go through it again and establish her ability to pay. So call and have a financial statement prepared, a 3562, and get an installment payment on something that she can live with, you know, maybe $100 a month or whatever.
Yeah, the FTB does have twice as long to collect than the IRS, and which makes it a lot more difficult, especially for the lower liabilities. There's really, it's very difficult to prove that a taxpayer cannot afford to pay lower liability, especially since the FTB has twice as long to collect. So good luck with that, Donald. Consider signing up for the VIP membership. If you need further guidance, again, we can walk you through the steps and give you some information, especially dealing with the FTB. We're very knowledgeable in dealing with the FTB. Okay, moving on to Ken or Kenneth. He's a CPA. His question is, a taxpayer is a sole proprietor who had not filed tax returns since 2009. If I send in a request to IRS to ask for 1099 MIS or W-2 reported for the taxpayer since 2009, would that trigger any issues?
Okay, so what you actually want is what's called a wage and income transcript. And it only goes back so far. I'm not sure. Can you go back 10 years?
Wage and income. No, I think it's 7 years.
You can't on a wage and income transcript. You can only go back so many years. But and can you order those online?
Yes, you can order those.
So what? So it won't trigger. I guess you're asking if it's going to trigger issues. I don't think so. All you're doing is getting transcripts. So I would order I think the stealthiest way you can do that is order the wage and income transcripts online. And then those will show the 1099s and the W-2s and the 1098s and everything. And you can prepare the returns based on the wage and income transcripts.
Now, here's an opportunity to update you guys on the line in case you haven't heard. The IRS is no longer going to be faxing over transcripts if you call in a request. They're doing that for privacy issues. You can only obtain them through e-services. We use a third-party software to be able to retrieve transcripts because it summarizes everything for us and puts it in a nice, fancy report. You might consider doing something similar. But a lot of these third-party providers are having difficulty because the IRS continues to update their guidelines or their authentication process because of privacy issues. But it also helps out, Norman, that they are no longer going to be masking the names of the transcripts. You know, you used to get the last four of the social, you used to only get partial names. All that is being updated, and now they're including full transcripts once again.
Well, I think there's two. There's masked and unmasked.
Right.
They're calling it. Right. So you can specify that you want an unmasked
Transcript.
Oh, transcript, yeah.
All right, but Ken, we can help you with transcripts. Again, if it's something that you're interested in, give us a call and we can guide you through that. Moving on to Laura. Laura is asking, in seminars and reading on this tax resolution, I have heard you should file a Freedom of Information Act request when dealing with IRS matters. What is the purpose of this? Is there a specific information on the FOIA that will disclose that is not available on your transcripts? I am unclear what I would be looking for, expecting to receive.
Yeah, so we don't use FOIA requests often. When we do, it's usually because the information we're seeking is older than the IRS goes back for transcripts. Like the IRS goes back, let's say 10 years on transcripts. So if you want a transcript for a year that's more than 10 years old, then you would need to do it through a FOIA request rather than a transcript. Also, you have there's several different kinds of transcripts, account transcript, wage and income transcript, which you just talked about, and tax return transcripts. But sometimes you want an actual copy of the tax return rather than the tax return transcript. And the only way to get the actual copy of the actual return is through a FOIA request. There's a form for that. The other time that you use it is there's two different kind of files that the IRS can go into. It's called master file and non-master file. And the thing is, if you're speaking to them on the phone, for instance, they'll only look at their computer, which only shows the master file. If you want it to go like older, or if it's because it dropped off because of inactivity or something, then you have to ask them, can you go into the non-master file? And sometimes in order to do that, you need a FOIA request. So generally, we probably do this less than once a year, I would think. And we deal with hundreds of clients a year. So it's not something that comes up often. And it's usually because you can't get the transcripts because they're too old.
Right. Okay, moving on to John. John is a CPA. He says he's new to tax resolution. He's been doing this for about 5 months. Using tax resolution software that originally had it calculated to estimate a reasonable OIC that IRS might accept. They eliminated the calculator from the program. Is there any guidelines that I can use?
So I have two suggestions. One is the IRS themselves has a calculator. If you go to their site on offers, they have a calculator to determine what amount of offer they'll accept. Also, if you complete the 433A OIC, that's really kind of a manual calculator program in that you fill in all the boxes on the 433A OIC, and then at the end, it tells you, put the number on line 10 here and subtract the number on line this and multiply by this. And then when you finish, you come up with a number that is the suggested amount that you submit as an offer. So the 433A OIC, which is required along with the form 656, when you submit an offer, actually puts you through all the calculations and you end up with the number. So even if you don't have it on the computer, you still need to go through it on the form anyways.
Yeah, and just those of you who are getting into resolution should know the formula that the IRS is looking at when it comes to an offer. So there are a couple types of offers, actually three types of offers, and then once you do for instance, the most common one, which is doubt as to collectability, which is the tax rate does not have the ability to full pay the taxes, which is why they should accept an offer. You have two options. You can either pay that all up front or you can pay it over periodic payments. So those two types of offers within the Dallas to Collectability has different calculations. But just real quickly, this is a formula you should probably jot down. What it translates to is the quick sale value of assets plus disposable income equals the minimum offer amount. Now, how you calculate quick sale value of assets and monthly disposable income is what Norman is referring to. That's on the 433A OIC. There's different percentages for assets. There's different ways to get the monthly disposable income using IRS local and national standards. So these are the intricacies that we train practitioners on how to do offers. So we do have workshops. We do have all their information to help guide you.
What they use to determine what a reasonable offer is they compare what you're submitting as an offer as to what they believe they could collect from the taxpayer if they engaged in forced collection, let's say a wage levy, over the life of the statute. So it depends how many years are left on the statute, how much they owe, and how much the IRS believes they could reasonably expect to collect over the life of the statute versus how much you're offering. And that's a determination that they use to make whether or not they accept the offer.
And by the way, that's information that's not on the 433 AOIC. So it's good to know what the IRS is really looking for when considering these offers that you submit. So this is why we have such a good reputation in getting a lot of these offers.
Well, there is some language after they tell you to multiply it by 12 or whatever, the disposable income by 12, that they compare that to how much they would collect over the life of the statute.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to the next question here. This is from Dana. And again, I mentioned these type of questions we get regularly. So, Dana, I do want to give you a little bit of guidance here, but we may have to just take this offline so we can share with you all the services that we provide. But Dana's asking, I just sold my accounting practice and plan to start another practice offering resolution service only. She wants to know who we are and would we be able to get her new practice started. So again, our focus with TaxResolutionInstitute.org is to help practitioners do the work proficiently, become an expert, but also we guide you with marketing and sales. So if you are just starting out, we give you guidance on how to be able to put your name out there, start attracting the right type of client base. And then once you got them in front of you, what do? How do you close them? How do you start generating these conversations ultimately the net revenue for you? So we do have a ultimate kit that gives you a lot of this guidance. Dana, I'll send it to you offline. If those of you who are online are interested in it, I'll send a quick link here and make sure that I include it in the follow-up email. But we do truly have the materials available to help guide you from beginning to end and make sure that you're successful. And part of what we do here is also providing you with that hand-holding, that extra guidance through the consultations, through the phone calls, through the emails, through the materials to make sure that you're helped in growing your own practice. So, Dana, we will take this offline. I'll send you an email, and then we can chat afterwards, probably tomorrow, because there's a lot of follow-up that needs to be done after today's event. But I'll make sure I reach out to you. Okay, moving on to Jeff. Jeff is asking, client owes approximately $58,000 in payroll taxes. Trust fund recovery penalty was never assessed, and the statute has passed for assessment. Since an offering compromise can't be filed until the TFRP has been assessed, is the client's only option to apply for an installment agreement?
Yeah, so I don't really understand this question because trust fund recovery penalty is assessed against responsible persons when a corporation owes payroll taxes. So is the $58,000 payroll taxes owed by a corporation? If it is, and the statute has expired for assessment, which is 3 years, then, yeah, the individual can't be assessed the trust fund recovery penalty, but the corporation would still owe the payroll taxes. If it's not a corporation and it's a sole proprietorship, then there is no trust fund recovery penalty because the sole proprietor owes all the tax, payroll tax, trust fund and non-trust fund personally anyways. So there's no purpose for a trust fund recovery penalty. So I'm not sure what you're asking, but if I don't know who owes the payroll taxes, a corporation or a, if it's a corporation, yeah, they can enter into an installment agreement.
All right.
If you're asking about the trust fund recovery penalty against the individuals, they don't owe anything and they never will.
All right, Jeff, hopefully that answers the question. If not, give us a call. We'll be happy to get your feedback and answer the question more accurately. You know, we're running out of time here soon, so I'm going to finish up with this question that was submitted prior to, and a lot of you have already submitted questions online here, so I'm going to try to get to as many as I can within the time allotted. So moving on to David. David says, if I'm preparing an offer for a client that has a 33% interest in a partnership, do I need to disclose all the business financials and assets or just disclose it as an interest in the company? He is a wage earner and has a 33% of a partnership.
Right. So I guess he receives a K-1, so that would go towards his income. And there's a place on the 433 AOIC that asks for like his value in stocks or interests in other businesses. So you would have to look at a balance sheet and determine what the taxpayers' equity is in the partnership, and that would be part of the offer because that would be, that's an asset that may or may not have value. So you have his income, but you also have his value in the partnership. But I don't think you'd have to go through all the details about it, but you would need to have, you would probably need a balance sheet and a P&L for the partnership.
All right. Thank you, Norman and David. Hopefully that answers your question. Okay, so question online is from Yelena. She says, I have a lot of clients in the software development industry. Should they be treated as SSBT for the purposes of IRC Section 199A? So this has to do with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and 199A deduction. This is something that we are going to cover in a lot of detail in the upcoming course. So, Yelena, consider taking that course and hopefully get to answer questions there. If you need an answer sooner than that, give us a call, and I will have one of our CPAs do a consultation with you, provided that you're a VIP member, to answer those questions directly. Thank you, Yelena. Moving on to Claire. This is a different Claire. So Claire says she has an issue in California where the CPA did not handle a first-time abatement penalty request properly. She indicated, first of all, just California does not have a first-time
penalty. So California, for state penalties, you have to go with reasonable cause.
Okay, and do you have any guidelines as to what qualifies for reasonable cause on the state of California? I mean, is there...
Yeah, it's called the prudent business person analysis, and what it says is, you know, why did they either not file timely or pay timely? And when they became aware of the problem, did they do what a reasonable and prudent business person would do to rectify the problem?
Got it.
Generally, it means blame it on the professional. So a taxpayer said that they relied on CPA advice, for instance, and the CPA gave bad advice. There's no downturn on the CPA. They're not going to go after him, but it could release the penalty against the taxpayer if again, if they reasonably relied on advice of a professional.
Yeah, so I'm reading her follow-up comments here, and apparently it is an IRS, and the CPA was withholding all the IRS letters, so the taxpayer never became aware that there was an issue. And she's wanting to know, is that reasonable cause? Is that something the taxpayer, or maybe even Claire, submit on behalf of the taxpayer?
That the taxpayer didn't get notice?
Yeah.
Because the notices were
sent to the CPA. Apparently the business address listed on the returns was the CPA.
Yeah, because usually the way it works is the IRS sends notices to the taxpayer, and if you check the box on the power of attorney to whoever you check the box to on the power of attorney, the state only sends it to one, either the power of attorney or the taxpayer, not both. But the IRS usually sends notices to both the power of attorney and the taxpayer. If the taxpayer says that only notices went to the power of attorney and not to the taxpayer, you know, I don't know, you can try it, but I think the IRS would say that it was the power of attorney's responsibility to notify the taxpayer of these notices, and that, you know, if they don't have reasonable cause against the IRS, they may have an action against the CPA.
Right. Okay. I'm going to cut it there, Norman, because I think we're ran out of time. David, I did see your question here. You answered a question for David regarding the partnership. Looks like he did not get the answer because he was interrupted. So I'll try to get you that information. Just so you know, everyone, these forums can be replayed. It does take me about a day or two to get them up on our website, so I'll make sure I send everyone a link. So if you want to listen to any of this again, we will go ahead and you can listen to it online and replay the entire call. So again, thank you very much, everyone, for today's Practitioners Forum. I will be hanging out online here, so continue to submit your questions through the chat box, and I will do my best to answer your questions. But our next Practitioners Forum, again, it's going to be on February 5th, so mark your calendars. There are a couple of events coming up this month, January 15th and January 22nd. I pushed the links. I will send a follow-up email with those details. And again, consider signing up for the VIP membership package. You get a lot of great deals and a lot of support to help you with your resolution cases. And also, if you're interested in that very exclusive private two-day event, with Peter Steffen, give me a call, send me an email, send me a chat link, and I will go ahead and make sure we start jotting down. Thank you very much, everyone. I will be online here answering your questions, so please don't leave if you still have questions. Talk to you soon.